This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Leonard Cohen is on a performance tour for the first time in 15 years, and he's singing the songs he became famous for in the 60s and 70s, like Suzanne, Chelsea Hotel, and Famous Blue Raincoat, as well as later songs he's known for, like I'm Your Man, Everybody Knows, and Democracy.
It's through a hole in the air from those nights in Tiananmen Square. It's coming from the feel that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
That recording is from the new double CD Leonard Cohen Live in London. Much of the motivation for performing again is financial. His former business manager stole just about all Cohen's money while Cohen was at his Zen Center, where he lived for 5 years. Although he won a $9.5 million settlement, it's unclear if he'll ever see a penny of it. I'm sorry that it was a financial disaster that led to his public return, but awfully glad that he's performing and recording again. I'm not sure any singer-songwriter better expresses cynicism, despair, romantic longing, and the desire for transcendence. Cohen published poems and novels before he started recording. When I spoke with him in 2006, he had just published a collection of poems called Book of Longing. I asked him to read a poem.
I'll just start reading this poem. It's called Thousand Kisses Deep. It's a long poem. Some of it is just meant to be read. Some of it is meant to be sung. I'll start with two or three verses of the part that's meant to be read. You came to me this morning and you handled me like meat. You'd have to be a man to know how good that feels, how sweet. My mirror twin, my next of kin, I'd know you in my sleep, and who but you would take me in a thousand kisses deep. I loved you when you opened like a lily to the heat. See, I'm just another snowman standing in the rain and sleet, who loved you with his frozen love, his second-hand physique, with all he is and all he was, a thousand kisses deep. I know you had to lie to me, I know you had to cheat, to pose all hot and high behind the veils of sheer deceit. Our perfect porn aristocrat, so elegant and cheap. I'm old, but I'm still into that, a thousand kisses deep.
That's Leonard Cohen, and here he is singing the part that's meant to be sung.
I'm turning tricks, I'm getting fixed, I'm back on Boogie Street. You lose your grip, and then you slip into the masterpiece. And maybe I had miles to drive, promises to keep. You ditch it all to stay alive. A thousand kisses deep.
That's Leonard Cohen from his CD, 10 New Songs, and the poem is published in his book, Book of Longing, which is a collection of his poems. Leonard Cohen, welcome to Fresh Air. It's so great to have you on the show. You know, there's the expression Boogie Street in that poem. What does Boogie Street mean to you?
Well, Boogie Street is what we're all doing. We're all on Boogie Street, and we believe that we leave it from time to time. We go up a mountain or into a hole, but most of the time we're hustling on Boogie Street one way or another.
Now you took a several-year long retreat from Boogie Street and went to a Zen center on the West Coast. And was it 5 years that you were there?
I was there 5 or 6 years, yes.
So you've been alternating, I guess, in your life between Boogie Street and meditation.
Well, actually, a monastery is is just part of Boogie Street. In fact, on Boogie Street, you go back to your flat or your apartment, and you close the door, and you kind of eliminate the rest of the world. You kind of eliminate Boogie Street. So there's really more respite from Boogie Street on Boogie Street than there is in a monastery, because a monastery is designed to eliminate private space. There's a saying, like pebbles in a bag, the monks polish one another. So in that kind of situation, you're always coming up against someone else. So in a certain sense, coming up against someone else all the time is Boogie Street.
Well, that must be really hard. I mean, I think of you as a fairly... your reputation as being kind of solitary and reclusive. So we always think of you as being reclusive when you're at the Zen Center. Now you're saying it's actually... you're always in the company of other people.
Yes, you're all... that. It's designed to overthrow that appetite for privacy.
Now... some of your poems have alternate lives as songs, like A Thousand Kisses Deep, which we opened with. And you've set poems by other poets to music, including one by Lord Byron. Is there much of a difference to you between a poem and a song lyric?
Well, there are certain poems that really do lie very gracefully on the page. For instance, to take an obvious example, if a poem by E. E. Cummings has a certain graceful display on the page, and some poems just naturally are meant to be absorbed in silence, where the tempo is decided on by the reader, and he could reverse it and forward it and linger. There are other kinds of lyrics that have their own metrical, imperial advice, and they invite you to move swiftly from line to line. And there are poems that are of mine that are always candidates for a song. Sometimes they don't make it, and sometimes they do.
Well, take a song like Famous Blue Raincoat. I think that is such an extraordinary lyric, and that it works as a poem. I mean, it's just so well written.
Some of them do. Some of them do.
Did you write that as a poem or as a song?
I wrote that as a song. But it's always the same for me, but it's only afterwards that I realize that I can, that it does arise with a melody. Or sometimes it arises with a melody that doesn't work, or the other thing happens. You know, a melody and a lyric arises, but you know the lyric doesn't deserve that kind of expression, and you're left with a good tune.
Would you talk a little bit about writing the lyric for that song?
I don't know. I don't remember how it arose. I don't remember how any of them get written.
What about the image? Do you remember how you got the image of the famous blue raincoat torn at the shoulder?
Well, I had a blue raincoat. It was a Burberry, and it had lots of buckles and various fixtures on it. It was a very impressive raincoat. I'd never seen one like it. I think I bought it in London, and... It always resided in my memory as some glamorous possibility that I never quite realized. So it began to stand for that unassailable romantic life, the opposite of a cloak of invisibility, the garment that would lead you into a marvelous... erotic and intellectual adventures. So that's what the symbol was, I think.
That's great. And was there somebody like the character in the song who was almost like a brother to you and then betrayed you by becoming involved with your lover? I mean, is this a story or is it based on on something that happened.
I oh, it's happened many times. I think that's happened to me a lot. It happens when one is in that that world. You know, fortunately, you know, I've been expelled from that particular dangerous garden. You know, by my age, so I'm not participating in these maneuvers with the frequency that I once did. But I think that when one is in that world, that you know, even if the situation does not result in any catastrophic splits, as it does in famous Berenko, one is always, you know, edging. And one is always protecting one's lover, and one is always, in a certain sense, on the edge of a jealous disposition.
Well, why don't we pause here, and soon we'll hear more of your poems, but let's hear one of your early songs, and this is Famous Blue Raincoat. My guest is Leonard Cohen.
Oh, the last time we saw you, you looked so much older. Your famous blue raincoat was torn at the shoulder. You'd been to the station to meet every train. Then you came home without Lily Marlene. And you treated my woman to a flake of your life. When she came back, she was nobody's wife. Well, I see you there with a rose in your teeth. One more thin gypsy thief. Well, I see Jane's away. She sends her regard.
That's Leonard Cohen singing his song, Famous Blue Raincoat. And Leonard Cohen has a new book of his poems called Book of Longing. You know, before we heard that song, you said that you were kind of exempt from that world of like sexual passion now, or and jealousy and all of that, because
one is not exempt, but one is not, you know, because one is not as welcome,
right,
into the garden.
That's, you know, it kind of reminds me of a line that you wrote that I really love from your song Tower of Song. You have the line, "I ache in the places I used to play."
Yeah,
what a great line.
Yeah.
Is that something you sweated over, or did you just kind of get that?
Well, you get it, but you get it after sweating. In other words, you discard. I'm in the situation where I can't discard anything unless I finish it. So I have to finish the verses that I discard. So it takes a long time. I have to finish it to know whether it deserves to survive in the song. So in that sense, all the songs take a long time. And although the good lines come unbidden, they're anticipated, and the anticipation involves a patient application to the enterprise.
You seem driven by two opposing engines. You know, on the one hand, so many of your songs are about, you know, lusts and appetites and beauty and you know, seeking pleasure of various sorts. And at the same time, you've also devoted years of your life to meditation and the desire for some kind of transcendence. So, and also your songs make it clear that you're not unfamiliar with, you know, depression and regret and fear, which are, again, the kind of things that one tries to quiet through meditation. Did you become a Buddhist because your desires were so dominant?
Well, I never became a Buddhist, to tell you the truth.
Should I just use the word practicing meditation?
Well, I don't even... I I bumped into a man many years ago who happened to be a Zen master. I wasn't looking for a religion. I had a perfectly good religion. I certainly wasn't looking for a new series of rituals or new scriptures or dogmas. You know, I wasn't looking for that. I wasn't looking for anything exalted or spiritual. I had a great sense of disorder in my life, of chaos, of depression, of distress. And I had no idea where this came from. And the prevailing psychoanalytic explanations at the time didn't seem to address the things I felt. So I had to look elsewhere, and I bumped into someone who seemed to be at ease with himself. It seems a simple thing to say. He seemed to be at ease with himself and at ease with others. And without ever deeply studying at the time what he was speaking about, it was the man himself that attracted me.
So this was your teacher. What kind of teacher? Is he still alive, I should ask first?
He's still alive. I just had tea with, well, it wasn't tea, it was liquor. I had a drink with him on his 99th birthday.
Whoa.
A lovely evening I spent with him.
How did you decide it was time for you to leave the Zen Center?
I don't know. I'm never sure why I do anything, tell you the truth. I don't know if I could tell you the whole story because it's very private. But I felt the reason I'd gone to see Roshi and had become a monk, it was appropriate to become a monk because if I was going to be in his scene, that was the uniform. As I've often said, if he had been a teacher of, you know, physics in Heidelberg, I would have learned German and studied physics in Heidelberg. So it was appropriate for me to become a monk. But the life was very rigorous. I mean, it's designed to overthrow a 21-year-old. So I was already in my, you know, 60s and late 60s. So there was that part of it, but I had the feeling that it wasn't doing any good and it wasn't really addressing this real problem of distress, which seemed to be the background of all my feelings and activities and thoughts. So I began to feel that this is a lot of work for very little return. That was the kind of superficial feelings I had. There were other feelings that are ambiguous and too difficult to describe. They deserve or probably should be described in song or poetry rather than conversation.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our 2006 interview with Leonard Cohen. The great songwriter and singer is back on the road doing his first tour in 15 years. The tour is largely a response to having been financially wiped out by his business manager, who absconded with Cohen's money. Cohen has a new CD called Live in London, featuring a concert from last July. I spoke with Leonard Cohen in 2006 after he published a collection of his poems called Book of Longing. Many of them were written at a Zen monastery in California, where he lived for 5 years. I'd like you to read another poem from your book, Book of Longing. And this is called Titles. Would you tell us when you wrote this?
I've been writing it for a while, but I finished it last winter in Montreal. It's a poem called Titles. I had the title poet, and maybe I was one for a while. Also, the title singer was kindly accorded me, even though I could barely carry a tune. For many years, I was known as a monk, I shaved my head and wore robes and got up very early. I hated everyone, but I acted generously, and no one found me out. My reputation as a ladies' man was a joke. It caused me to laugh bitterly through the 10,000 nights I spent alone. From a third-story window above the Parc de Portugal, I've watched the snow come down all day. As usual, there's no one here. There never is. Mercifully, the inner conversation is canceled by the white noise of winter. I am neither the mind, the intellect, nor the silent voice within. That's also canceled. And now, gentle reader, in what name, in whose name, do you come to idle with me in these luxurious and dwindling realms of aimless privacy?
That's a great poem. That's titles from Leonard Cohen's collection of poems, The Book of Longing, or Book of Longing. I just particularly like the part because I think this is really funny. I hated everyone, but I acted generously, and no one found me out.
It's true, huh?
And that was in the monastery that you're talking about.
Yeah. It's not the whole story, but it's enough of the story to justify the line.
I want to talk with you a little bit how your voice has changed over the years. When you started performing, you had a much kind of, you know, clearer and higher voice. Your voice has deepened and roughened over the years. And we can hear it when you speak. You can hear it in your records from the late 80s on. Has that changed because of cigarettes? Or?
Well, about 500 tons of whiskey and you know, a million cigarettes, 50, 60 years of smoking, but I don't smoke anymore.
What? How'd you stop?
I had my throat examined. I was having trouble getting the smoke down, you know, so I thought I'd better have my throat examined. And, you know, it's a very disagreeable procedure. They put a little camera up your nose and down your throat. And the doctor looked there. There was a scowl on his face. He said, I said, well, okay, do I have it? And he said, no, but you're on the Royal Road. So I thought I'd better give up the smokes.
Do you feel, as a songwriter, do you feel a connection to, say, Irving Berlin, Cole Porter, Harold Arlen, those guys, the kind of classic American popular songwriters?
Oh, well, I think they're better than I am. I just think they know more about music. Someone like Cole Porter, his rhymes are, you know, much, much more elegant than mine. I have a very, very limited... a very limited kind of expression, but I've done the best that I can with it, and I've worked it as diligently as I can. But I don't really, except for one or two songs, maybe like Hallelujah, or If It Be Your Will. I think those are probably my two best songs. I don't think I rise to the level of those great songwriters.
It's funny, you know, you have one recording of Irving Berlin's song Always, and the last few lines are a lyric that you added of your own.
Right.
And it's such a sweet song, you know, I'll be loving you always with a love that's true always, you know, not just for an hour, not just for a day, you know, not for just a minute.
It's such a beautiful
song.
Yeah,
and so, but your last few lines take this, you know, really lovely, sweet song, and suddenly it's like really dark and sour.
That's, you can depend on me for that.
Exactly. I'm just going to recite your last few lines, if you don't mind.
Sure, I don't remember them.
Not for just a second or a minute or an hour, not just for the weekend and a shakedown in the shower, not just for the summer and the winter going sour, but always.
That's good.
It's great.
That's really good.
When I hear that, I think of you almost as having sat down and said, Irving Berlin is great. This is one of the differences between me and him in our sensibilities.
Well, of course, the treatment of the song, is so very different. I think I changed the tempo, too. I think his is 3-4, and I changed it to 4-4 and, you know, brought in a completely different kind of, and a kind of drunken version of it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And do you think that you are more kind of cynical in some of your songwriting than any of those kind of classic guys could ever be?
That's a question I've just been asking myself in the past few days, because somehow I've heard Louis Armstrong's "What a Wonderful World It Could Be." Every turn I hear it for some odd reason. It's such a very beautiful song. And I think to myself, you know, why don't I leave a couple of songs like that behind me, you know? And I'd like to, you know. There's a lot of things I'd like to do, but when you're actually in the trenches and you know, you're in front of the page, or you know, the guitar or the keyboard under your hands, you know, you have to deal with where the energy is. You know, what arises, what presents itself with a certain kind of urgency.
I want to play one of your very cynical songs, and it's one of my favorites of yours, and it's everybody knows from your 1988 album, I'm Your Man. And, I mean, to get this song at its really full cynicism, there's a movie called Exotica from 1994 in which, by Adam McGuigan, in which, like, a young teenage girl has this set piece that she dances all the time at a strip club. And she's always dressed as like a schoolgirl, and like the pleated skirt and the button-down shirt, and she strips to your song "Everybody Knows." Before we hear it, would you talk a little bit about writing it?
I wrote it with Sharon Robinson, mm-hmm. a woman with whom I've collaborated on many songs. I don't really remember. I wanted to write a tough song. I had the feeling that, I was Humphrey Bogart or some. I began it in France, in Paris, at a cafe in the 14th arrondissement, and I don't know who I thought I was at the time, but it was, you know, somebody who you couldn't put anything over on. I think that was the mood. You know, I'm a guy. Well, you know, I'm incredibly gullible in my ordinary civilian life, but as I was sitting there, I was the guy that you couldn't put anything over on.
Well, here's "Everybody Knows," Leonard Cohen, recorded in 1988.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guy's lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows. Everybody knows that the boat is leaking. Everybody knows. Everybody got this broken feeling, like their father or their dog just died. Everybody talking to their pockets. Everybody wants a box of chocolates and a long stem rose. Everybody knows.
I want to ask you a couple of questions about beauty. There's something very vexing about beauty when it comes to people, you know, you don't need to be told about the pleasures of being the presence of beauty and how attractive beautiful people are. But when it comes to physical beauty, that can also sometimes be a superficial beauty, yet you can, some people almost become like a slave to it, to either embodying it or being attached to somebody who does. In your song Chelsea Hotel, there's a few lines that go, excuse me for kind of ruining your lines by quoting them, but
you don't ruin them.
you're right. You told me again you preferred handsome men, but for me you would make an exception. And clenching your fist for the ones like us who were oppressed by the figures of beauty, you fixed yourself. You said, well, never mind. We are ugly, but we have the music. Do you think of yourself as being someone who has been oppressed by the figures of beauty?
Oh, yeah. Well, there's no question about that. I still am. You know, I still stagger and fall. Of course, I have that. It just happens to me all the time. And, you know, you just have to get very careful about it because it's inappropriate for an elderly chap to register, authentically his feelings, you know, because they really can be interpreted. So you have to get quite covert as you get older, you know, or you have to find some avuncular way, you know, of responding. But still, you just really are just, you're wounded, you stagger, and you fall.
In the song, you know, the character says to the singer, we are ugly, but we have the music. And the character says to you that they preferred handsome men, but for you they would make an exception. So if you don't see yourself as physically beautiful, what has it been like to feel like you're a slave to beauty, yet feel that you don't embody that yourself?
Well, I've asked this question to a lot of people that are, certifiably beautiful, who don't feel that they're beautiful. I think this is a platitude, but it's a common experience. So I don't think anybody beats the rap in this realm. So we all feel when we're loved that some concession has been made, and we probably, none of us deserve the love that we expect. So when it comes to us, we can legitimately understand it as an exception to the rule.
But you never felt like it was a, like,
there are times that I thought I was good looking.
Uh-huh.
You know, I don't know about how you feel, but I mean, there are times I felt I was good looking, but most of the time, you know, especially, you know, the damn thing about it is that, you know, there's comparisons around, you know. So there's people around you that always look better, you know. And, since we're in a competitive world, especially the world of love and romance, one never feels really up to it. And now and then I have, you know, but most of the time I haven't.
But you've never felt like, oh, some kind of almost like double standard was going on where you responded to beauty and yet felt that in your physical presence didn't embody that yourself?
Oh, yeah, I've felt, you know, like a snail. Like a worm, like a slug, you know, many times.
Okay.
I think the last time was this morning at breakfast. I'd like to recite the lyric of one of my more recent poems, if we have a moment. This is how it goes. I used to be your favorite drunk. Good for one more laugh. Then we both ran out of luck, and luck was all we had. You put on a uniform to fight the Civil War. I tried to join, but no one liked the side I'm fighting for. So let's drink to when it's over, and let's drink to when we meet. I'll be waiting on this corner where there used to be a street. It wasn't all that easy when you up and walked away. But I'll leave that little story for another rainy day. I know your burden's heavy as you wheel it through the night. The guru says it's empty, but that doesn't mean it's light. So let's drink to when it's over, and let's drink to when we meet. I'll be standing on this corner where there used to be a street. You left me with the dishes and a baby in the bath, and you're tight with the militias, and you wear their camouflage. Well, I guess that makes us equal, but I want to march with you. Just an extra in the sequel to the old red, white, and blue. So let's drink to when it's over, and let's drink to when we meet. I'll be waiting on this corner where there used to be a street. It's going to be September now for many years to come. Many hearts adjusting to that strict September drum. I see the ghost of culture with numbers on his wrist salute some new conclusion that all of us have missed. So let's drink to when it's over, and let's drink to when we meet. I'll be waiting on this corner where there used to be a street.
That's fantastic. And that's a song, too?
Yeah, it's a song. I wrote it with Anjani. I got the tune. I put down a few versions of it, but I don't have it. I haven't nailed it yet. But it's on its way.
Man, that poem just really kind of gets to one of the things I love about your writing, which is at the same time you're kind of trapped in the world, but smart enough to know you're trapped. Do you know what I mean? It's like you're in it and looking down at it at the same time.
Yeah, that's good. That's on the operating table. A lot of people have that experience, huh?
Well,
the anesthetic does it to you. You're being operated on, and yet you're on top of the thing, looking down at your body being destroyed. That's everybody's condition.
It's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much for reading some of your work and talking with us.
Oh, it's been really good. Thanks so much for inviting me.
Leonard Cohen recorded in 2006. He's on his first performance tour in 15 years, and he has a new CD called Leonard Cohen Live in London, recorded in concert last July. This is Fresh Air. Like so many big names in film comedy, director Greg Mottola got his start on the cult TV series Freaks and Geeks, along with Judd Apatow, Seth Rogen, Jason Segel, and others. He went on to direct the Apatow-produced Superbad, and now has a more personal film, Adventureland, set in a Pittsburgh amusement park. It stars Jesse Eisenberg of The Squid and the Whale and Kristen Stewart of Twilight, as well as Martin Starr of Freaks and Geeks. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
The director Greg Mottola is light on his unhappy feet. Consider his last film, the hit Superbad, written by Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg. It came on like a raucous end-of-high-school comedy about chasing girls, getting drunk, and crashing cars. And yes, it was that. But there was an undercurrent of sadness and dread. It was closer to American Graffiti than American Pie, with a whiff of blue velvet, as the dweebish teens got drunk and stoned and edged closer to losing their virginity. They entered a world where all the grown-ups were scarily unhinged. Adventureland, which Mottola also wrote, is another coming-of-age film, this time quiet and forlorn, yet still somehow light on its feet. What could be funereal is carnivalesque, literally. The time is 1987, the setting a semi-dilapidated amusement park in Pittsburgh, where the recent college grad protagonist, James, played by Jesse Eisenberg, is forced to work when his alcoholic dad gets demoted and can't underwrite his summer in Europe. James is supposed to go to graduate school in New York in the fall, but for now, he's marooned. The park, Adventureland, is owned by a husband-wife team played by those Saturday Night Live loony minimalists Bill Hader and Kristen Wiig.
This is James, and he's applying for a games job.
Games? Oh, great.
Good.
Let's get you set up.
Actually, Bobby, I prefer a rides job if it's still open.
You look more like a games guy, plus Sarah got at the
game's okay. application. So, all
okay.
right.
Yeah, no, I
My name is Bobby. Okay, rules. No freebies. No free turns for your friends. No free upgrades. No free food.
So just nothing is free here.
Everybody has to pay for everything. And more importantly, working in games, no one ever wins a giant panda.
We don't have that many left.
Cool.
Can you give me a t-shirt, please?
Here, I have a resume. I don't know if you still want to take a look at it.
James, am I pronouncing that right? James?
Yeah. Okay, by accepting this t-shirt, you are...
Hired.
Well, Sorry. Usually a more of a ceremonial thing.
As James, I am pronouncing that right. Jesse Eisenberg is never a droopy hangdog. His skinny frame lists from side to side, as if he's unable to muster the will to show gravity who's boss. He's still a virgin, which you'd think he'd keep to himself. But what makes him both riveting and cringeworthy is his compulsive blabbing. There's nothing too personal he won't say with a little prodding. Or no prodding. It gushes out. His sexual inexperience, his crushes, his heartbreaks. And oddly enough, women seem to find that attractive instead of embarrassing, mainly because he's different from the bad boys. James falls hard for M, a melancholy co-worker played by Kristen Stewart, and she's attracted back. Only she's secretly carrying on with the park's too-cool, married fix-it guy, Connell, played by Ryan Reynolds. The scenes in which James breathlessly confides in the older, experienced Connell about his dates with M are positively traumatizing. Romantic triangles like this are commonplace in movies and soaps, but Mottola plays old songs in new keys and strikes dissonant, unsettling notes. All the characters are old enough to live on their own, but are still at home, chafing miserably at their dependence. I could feel in my bones James's self-disgust as he lay on his old bed, alienated from his parents' values and lifestyle, yet comfortable too, because this is the world he knows, and because he doesn't have to pay rent. At least James is in the world, still hopeful. Mottola gives us a contrasting geek, Joel, played by Martin Starr, who cultivates a nihilistic detachment, which might make him cool if defeat weren't written all over him. Adventureland isn't just a boy's life. Many scenes incorporate M's perspective, and Kristen Stewart seems more alive than she did in Twilight, opposite the vampire hunk with the tall forehead. Her murky emotions are amazingly clear. The movie's only disappointment, apart from too little Kristen Wiig, is that Mottola writes the adult parts so broadly. It's one thing for M to describe her stepmother as a status-obsessed witch, another to have the actress telegraph that description in every line. But Adventureland transcends its formula plot, because the central metaphor, the amusement park, has an eerie resonance. Offering little in the way of adventure, it comes to stand for stagnation land, with the shallow comforts of rides and games and suburban diversions rotting before your eyes. The real roller coaster, life, is just outside the park.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.